A few minutes for the stragglers, but I'm going to start now, and we're going to leave a good piece open for discussion. I'm going to have a 10-minute harangue, followed by Stephen. Stephen and Elizabeth are going to
Liz.
Then Liz.
Thank you.
I'm trying to be formal, Liz. They're going to contradict me or support me or whatever. I can never predict what they're going to say, so we'll have to see. But I'm going to give some background in it, and I'm going to go very quickly, and it'll set the stage for our later discussions. The definition of OERs by the UNESCO is the open provision of educational resources enabled by ICTs for use by the community of users. And they say for non-commercial purposes, which I don't necessarily agree with. I'd support a broader definition than that. Why do we need open education resources? And I guess the first one, and from a very positive standpoint, the world's knowledge is a public good in general, and knowledge belongs to all of us. And the web provides an extraordinary opportunity for us all to share and use these resources. So we should be doing that. But more seriously for Canada in the environment we're in now, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is coming to Canada, and it was just the new copyright bill was announced before Parliament a couple of weeks ago, and we'll be seeing the text of it sometime in June or possibly July. And I'm under no illusions that it's going to be more open and freer. It's going to bring in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is the bill that puts digital locks onto copyrighted material and makes it illegal for you to break the lock, even if you do it for a legal purpose. The Digital Rights Management, one of the best reasons we can say that we're opposed to it is where Amazon just they sold George Orwell's book and to people on their Kindles and then they took it away from them. They just went to their Kindles and just took it out. So very much trespassing on the rights of the users. And again, they're working on the perfect device, a CD that self-destructs. This is what they want. They basically, the vendors want to control when, where, how, and why you use whatever you buy. So you're no longer buying something that you own. You're licensing something under the restrictions that they give you. And they, with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, they'll be able to enforce that. Another reason why we need to move towards open education resources is access copyright, where they've swooped down on our schools. Every student in Canada pays about $5 each, I think it's $5.36, for the right to copy materials for use in the classroom. And they want $45 each for each post-secondary student. And this is particularly onerous from this point of view, is they're saying for every full-time equivalent student, you pay $45. So if your university is using 90% open access material and 10% proprietary material, you still pay $45 per full-time equivalent student. Whereas another university may be using 90% proprietary material and only 10% open material, and they're paying $45. So what it does, it not only creates a disincentive for using open materials, it creates an incentive for you to use the proprietary materials more, in which case the next license that comes up, they'll put the price up even higher. So that's a big problem with it. There's different types of OERs, and I'm not going to go into detail in them, but different types of textbooks, units, multimedia objects, full courses, tools, free and open source software. There's open education resources. There's a lot of things you can do with them, and And the real value of open education resources is that you can do things with them. Augment them, edit them, customize, aggregate, reformat, mashups. Do the types of things that Alec showed us this morning. And this is a really a major use that we can use open educational resources for that we're prohibited from doing with copyrighted material. David Wiley says, you know, they're for reuse, rework, remix, and redistribute. Again, the UNESCO has put it very clear that open education resources are crucial for world development. The goal of developing together a universal educational resource for the whole of humanity. And they want to mobilize the whole of the worldwide community of educators. And this has come out in discussions we had, and people say, well, you know, what's the economic model for open education resources? And the fact is our public institutions have the money for open to create, use, and share open education resources. The fact is that we're using the money to buy proprietary material. And some companies like Elsevier, where the university professors do the research, they give it to the Elsevier journals, and then they make money out of it. And the president there made £4.5 million last year, not dollars, pounds. And there were 7 vice presidents who made over £1 million. And we have the same thing in Canada with Access Copyright. We don't know how much they're making, but what we do know is 25% of the money they collected has gone to the salaries of the executives and other employees. So there's a huge number of places where you can get open education resources. Here's just some of them. They come from large universities, they come from small schools, they come from different types of institutions or different types of communities. There's a wide range of people participating in the open access, open education resource movement. The licenses, Creative Commons is the most common, with some rights reserved. That is attribution. You say you can use it, but you've got to attribute to me. You can make derivatives or not. You have to use it exactly as it is, or you can change it. Can it be used by commercial companies? And the Creative Commons, the beauty of the Creative Commons license is that there's a wide variety of different possibilities. The one I would recommend and prefer is just make it public domain so people have no problem with it at all. They can do what they want. People say, well, they won't attribute me, but I don't believe that. I don't think there's too many people who are using Mark Twain's work and saying, I wrote it. I mean, that's not happening. In universities, there's ethical standards in schools that you attribute, and so you don't need a restriction on it. And even if you have a restriction on it, the type of person who would claim your work is not going to care anyway. Attribution is ethical. And for-profit is not always evil. People are thinking of the big old companies who are going to take your work and make all kinds of money for it. But in many of the developing countries, some of the schools that are most active in bringing education to the poor masses are for-profit schools. And quite often they have a better reputation in many countries than the public school. And, you know, why would we exclude them? So, you know, why not make it full public domain? But the reality is, so far, there's little take-up of the use of educational resources. We're talking about millions of free, open resources available on the web. At least 15,000 full university courses available on the web. Some of the reasoning is that there's little reward or recognition for the authors. Few learners are engaging with the content. People are looking for a business case, and there's not very much of the remixing and reposting like we saw Alex doing. A solution to this is building these vibrant communities who make use of these resources. And they are being building these communities. The Open Courseware Foundation is growing very rapidly. A problem with them, of course, as the people bring up, is localization. You've got to make it available for the different cultures. And that's one reason why you want to make it, that you can make derivatives and you can use it in different ways, is so as people can adapt it to their own cultural perspectives. And Obama's put $500 million into the development of OERs in the United States colleges. And has he cut it?
Yeah, it was cut. Yeah.
It was cut. Obama announced
intended
$500 million, but in the present budgetary constraints, I guess that disappeared, yeah. So MIT was one of the leaders in the Open Courseware Foundation, so people before MIT, people were saying, well, they're lower quality and everything, but when MIT does it, nobody can say that, even though it probably is lower quality. I don't think they are better quality than our courses. Our courses are instructionally designed, and theirs are just syllabus and collections. So these are some examples, Wiki Educator, Kuriki, Project Gutenberg Connections. These are some of the biggies. There's a large community of users all around the world. And I'd like to finish with a few quotes here. McIlvenny was telling us, when people are free to do as they please, they usually imitate each other. There are no chaste minds. Minds copulate wherever they meet. And there's nothing more human than copying. From even before the baby's born, the baby is copying. And copying and sharing are part of what it is to be human. And I'll quote Stephen here. I guess he could say it himself, but no. Maybe I can say it better. It's fascinating. It's fascinating that we live in a society where openness and sharing can actually be considered crimes. And it is sad that that's what's happening. But, a papal encyclical, the Pope comes to the rescue. On the part of rich countries, there is excessive zeal for protecting knowledge through an unduly rigid assertion of the right to intellectual property. So we can be assured that God is on our side. So we're on the side of the angels. We don't have to apologize for that. And here's some questions that should pop up in the discussion. Do you use OERs? Have you created them? Why don't we use them? And will students use them and avoid your materials? Or are they doing so? So with that, I'll pass it along to Stephen. And Liz will be waiting to put us down.
Okay. I was sort of hoping to go after her, but that's okay. Yeah.
Well, that's deliberate, Stephen.
It's deliberate? Okay. You invited me here to frustrate my will. Just kidding. Look, I've got two major things I want to talk about. I'm going to talk very briefly because I want to argue with Liz, and I'm sure that's what we're all here for. I'm just kidding. Well, I never get the chance.
I've never experienced this before. No, you just keep going. Seriously.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, this could be fun. And we've got lots of time, right?
Yes.
So, mostly I'm going to respond to Rory, which is kind of what I anticipated. So maybe I am in the right place after all. Right, enough stalling. Two major things. First of all, I want to talk a bit about open educational resources and commercialization. Secondly, I want to talk about open educational resources and consumerism. Now, the idea of open educational resources is, of course, as Rory said, to provide learning resources that can be shared freely. And the concept of free is important here, and he quite appropriately put up Stallman's Four Freedoms in the discussion of open learning resources. Now, one of the things that comes up all the time, and Rory brought it up, is that included among those freedoms is the idea that you have to have the idea, or you have to have the ability to reuse these things commercially, to sell them. And in defense of this argument, it is often put that in English, there are two meanings of free, free libre, in English, we conflate two meanings of free, free libre and free gratuit. Free libre, liberty, doing what you want, stuff like that. Gratuit, free of cost. Yeah, free as in freedom versus free as in beer. And I've been thinking about that, and as time has gone by, I've been thinking more and more that these two senses of free are actually correctly merged in English and not incorrectly merged in English, and that free as in beer is an important part of free as in freedom. I mean, if you think about things like the poll tax, the reason why it's so pernicious is that it puts a price on voting. And, you're not free anymore when you have to pay money for your freedom. So my own preference when licensing open educational resources, and I'm not saying that this must be the preference for everyone, but my own preference is to attach a non-commercial clause to it. Quite a bit of the time from people like, well, especially David Wiley, but a little bit from Rory and others, the argument goes that we have to have all open educational resources under the same license in the same way so that they can all be merged and mixed together. And that license needs to be this open public domain, even more free than free kind of license. And I've always resisted that. The reason why I've resisted that is that when you have commercial use, there are always conditions. There is no such thing as free commercial use. And the most common condition is you have to pay money, right? And if you have to pay money, it's not free. I'm sorry. I hate to have to be the one to say that because it seems so blazingly obvious. If you have to pay money, it's not free. But even where there isn't an exchange of money, if there's commercial use, there are typically conditions attached. There's been a whole big kerfuffle over Facebook recently, and the story, I think, is relatively well known because it's repeated over and over and over again, not just in digital commerce, but in commerce generally, where corporations offer a good or service and then mine the users of that good or service for information and then turn around and sell the information. So basically, Facebook and similar companies are turning free access into a commodity that they can sell. And, there's a limitation of freedom that comes in there as well. It's a loss of your privacy. It's a loss of your own control over your own personal information. It's a condition. And it creates an encumbrance. It creates difficulties in using this information in the way that you would freely like to be able to use it. Rory says, for profit is not always evil. Well, I agree. I think people should be able to make money. I am the last person to argue against commercial enterprise. People need to eat. People need to have houses and raise their children and all of that. But in the case of open educational resources, commercialism runs counter to the purpose of open educational resources. And just very briefly, two examples. First of all, when there are commercial versions of open educational resources, the first thing the commercial entity will attempt to do is to close off access to that free version by creating proprietary marketplaces. Now, you go into a Chapters or any bookstore in the country, how many free books will you find there? You won't find any. And they're attempting to do similar sorts of things with the Kindle marketplace and the iTunes marketplace. And I know I know there are free contents on these marketplaces now, but dollars to donuts, when they're the only place you can get content, there won't be any free content on them. The second is that the commercialization of open educational resources also leads to these companies pushing us toward a producer-consumer model of these resources. And the reason for that is this is a model that is much better for their own purposes. And that leads to the second part of the remarks that I want to make. And the second part of the remarks addresses OERs and consumerism. Typically, a discussion of open educational resources leads to a discussion of sustainability. And I think there was a slide there, Rory, where you talked about some of the foundations and things like that. This discussion of sustainability is almost always predicated on a publisher model of open educational resources, where there is some agency, a university, a publisher, whatever, that produces, and some agency that funds that production, and then another agency that receives the results of the production. I've talked about various sustainability models over the years, but these various sustainability models are almost all based around the idea of raising money in order to pay this producer, raising it through foundations, raising it through governments, raising it through upselling or value-added reselling, raising it through advertising, raising money and then turning around and paying the organizations that create content. This is why commercial producers of content want to see this consumerist model retained. They want to see it retained because all of the efforts that are directed toward creating open educational resources to help poor people end up funneling money toward them. Now, to me, and this is just me, and maybe I'm the only person in the world who thinks this is odd, but all the money that's raised by Hewlett and Shuttleworth and Wellcome Trust and all that, all of this money raised, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to create educational resources to support international development gets sent to places, poor, poor places like MIT and Harvard and Stanford. And it just seems ridiculous to me. Now, in addition to that, we also have, and it came up again in your slides, Rory, when you have resources that are produced by these publication houses, they're very seldom appropriate for the people who are receiving them. And so there is the, of course, additional cost, which must be funded, of localization and all of that. Now, I've recommended on numerous occasions to UNICEF conferences, to OECD conferences, that the model of open educational resources should be revised. That what we should be attempting to do is not paying publishers to provide resources for poor people, an argument that has largely gone unheard. The latest OECD report on it was Giving Content for Free was the title. Rather, what we should be doing is creating capacity and helping people develop their own resources, especially people in countries without capacity. And an appropriate strategy for the promotion of open educational resources would be the promotion of a strategy where these resources are produced by the communities that will be learning from them. And, you know, when we talk about the definition of free, these sort of activities meet my definition of free much more closely because, you know, the production of the learning resource is actually, in many cases, a better way to learn about the subject matter than simply receiving content. And the production of your own learning resources is something that not only teaches, it empowers, and it emancipates. And to me, these are much more fundamental definitions of free than the freedom to get something for free and block access to it by charging money. And that's my remarks. Over to you, and back to you.
First, who in the audience is from St. John? New Brunswick today. Well, happy birthday. Well done. Well done. Secondly, greetings to all of those who are listening beyond this room. We've all been asked if we agree to have our comments recorded. I guess you have as well. Yes?
Over here.
Yeah, yeah. So you haven't? Well, just
recall the Rubicon. It's not that I care about it.
Okay, well, anyway, just greetings to the distance people. Now, these two seem to be living in terror that I'm going to say horrible things that will make their hair go gray. But I'm not really. Too late, he says, yes. First, I want to tell you what my street cred is regarding OERs. First of all, I had 17 years in Australia as a professional librarian. Are there any librarians here in the room? No? Okay. But if you meet one, ask them about the general principle of free OERs, as in library books and books and other materials in libraries. That taught me an awful lot. Secondly, I'm in the field of adult education as well as distance education, and as well as being a community social activist. 32 years in distance education, fighting all the time for better access, not necessarily free, but certainly much better access to all kinds of educational resources. The next thing is, I once answered a question and created a metaphor: how can technology be like a cat? And it was published in the US Journal Educational Technology in 1999. And my friend Margaret Haughey of Athabasca University was sitting in a conference in the USA a number of years ago, and she heard the speaker giving his metaphor of how can technology be like a cat. And she said, I've heard this before, but it was not attributed. And I must say, that made me mad. I don't mind him using it as long as he says it's not his own. The last piece of credibility before I get on to the major point here is that two American colleagues and I are going to walk, we hope we're going to walk the talk about a better and free access to materials, because we've recently completed a long manuscript on the issue of flexibility in higher education. How do we critically unpack that concept? And we've sent it to Athabasca University's Open Press. So this is going to be our experiment to see what happens with our own OER that could be chopped up into 25 little pieces. So now I'll get into the substance and then hand over to you folk. So here's my provocation. If OERs are the answer, what was the question? What was the question? And here I'll give you a range of possible questions that might apply. Do teachers need more pieces of cognitive Lego? Do students look for additional resources, or do they look for better replacements of what they were given? Do we want to use OERs in order to reduce the load of the increasingly casualized teaching forces that we're now using? Do administrators want to industrialize teaching functions? You can tell I'm being deliberately provocative here, just to get your brain cells moving. Do institutions look for easier forms of quality assurance? Are technological innovators or early adopters looking for a new field to till while the rest of us cope with the weeds in the old fields of teaching or companion fields of teaching? Mark Twain, Rory referred to Mark Twain. One of you did. And I recalled his wonderful saying, history does not repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. So the issue with the OERs, for me, as part of my critical thinking toolkit, is to say, what's come before that OERs may be resonating with? And what did we learn before that may be transferable to what we're trying to do today? So regardless of whichever of these questions takes your fancy, the issue for me is how to do critical and constructive thinking around this particular issue, because it to me, it's a very complex issue. And we may be moving, and this is something I cooked up as Stephen and Rory were talking, it seems to me that we're moving from digital divides through to digital dividends, through to digital dictatorships by commercial interests, and then we will wreak digital revenge. Don't you think that's good? I just had that flash. Had to tell you. Digital divides to digital dividends to digital dictatorships to digital revenge. Now, I predict we're somewhere around how to get the digital dividends working well, and if things go bad, we'll move into digital revenge before the big bad commercial operations do. Does that make sense to anyone? Yeah? Okay. So critical thinking. So how do we do critical thinking? I had to work with some New Zealand colleagues recently, and in thinking about the kinds of technologies that I like to be dealing with, I came to about six characteristics of any technology. And as I tell them to you very quickly, you can think, does this relate in any way to how I understand OERs? I'm looking for technologies of practicality, of imagination, of some regulation of my behavior, particularly towards efficiency, towards comfort and ease of use, towards variety, and towards reliability. Practicality, imagination, regulation, comfort, variety, and reliability. So when I hear any discussion about OERs, or I go onto an OER site, as I have been in the last few weeks, and trying to navigate my way through, I keep thinking of the concept of elegance, because many of these sites, to me, are not yet elegant. You heard the book, Matthew May's recent book called In Pursuit of Elegance. Have you read about this concept of elegance? It's used in the natural sciences and applied sciences. It's like the architectural motto, less is more. I go onto these websites as an innocent learner. I don't want more. I want less. And you try going into some of these OER websites. They're still in this stage of development where there's just too much there. So, and that's one thing for me, qualities of this particular technology and which ones will we most respond to. A second way that I try and think is captured by ROI, R-O-I, return on investment. We can talk about institutional returns on investment. We can talk about teacher returns on investment. We can talk of administrative and policy returns on investment. My issue now is with the students, and I don't know of too many studies, you might know, Rory, that qualitatively ask the students who are using OERs how they are actually responding to them and what do they want out of the experience, which may be different from what the educators think they want. So I always say, go to the source. Every time, go to the source. We also know that students are very wise and they're very pragmatic, and they will behave like water flowing in a river. You know what water does? Is it flows down a rocky river?
Erodes.
It erodes the banks. What else does it do? Path of least resistance. Thank you. Take a pay rise. So, if we were students, wouldn't we be thinking, oh, OERs, okay? How will that help me do my work? Any of you get Maclean's magazine, I really recommend you find the issue for February the 22nd of this year, Who Needs a Prof? Did anyone read this? Yeah, some people are nodding, right? A journalist who is a political science student at one of the universities in Ottawa. Not whether she says it. Anyway, she got tired of what the university in Ottawa was giving her, so she used OERs from Harvard and Yale and everywhere else, got top marks in her exams. She jettisoned what the University of Ottawa gave her, got good grades passing her exams. And then, of course, the big question comes up. Well, you didn't provide me with good enough resources, so why should I pay the full amount of your course fee? Which I thought was a very interesting question. So anyway, this is that. Just while I'm on literature, in 2009, the British journal Open Learning, you can get it full text online, of course, via the databases at the cost of the library. But this issue of Open Learning is a special issue on open educational resources. And a good friend and colleague of mine, Susan D'Antoni, in UNESCO, was the editor. Very practical, very down to earth, got good lots of information about some of the issues involved in this. So the last two things I want to mention. This is not all I have in the notes, but it's time I stopped. Rory did mention some of the issues. I've got some more, but you can get some idea of how my thinking is here. Criteria. How many of you know Everett Rogers' work on the criteria for long-term adoption of an innovation? Yes, another pay rise then. It's worth looking at. Look it up on Google. But he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 criteria that need to be in place if an innovation is to carry long-term adoptive power. Relative advantage to things already in existence. Compatibility with existing equipment and resources. Perceived low complexity of use. Reliability, familiarity, and being observable to others who can then say, oh, gee, that's really good. Got to go and try that. And then you get the cascade effect. So I'll end with something that is becoming increasingly important to me as part of my critical thinking toolbox, and that is to think with ethical intent. We must deliver on what we promise, rather than just saying, well, look, isn't this really great? Now go and dig around on this site. Because my experience with very pragmatic students is they'll buy that the first time round. They won't buy it the second time around. So that's it for me. I hope we've rattled your brains enough that you don't fire arrows at us, but we're all together talking about this issue.
Thank you very much. So we'll open it up for questions or discussion now, and we can respond to each other. But do you want us to do it first, or do you want to go from the audience? I think Stephen seems to be wanting to go. So
well, and I am on the panel, so. I should at least get a couple minutes.
Go for it.
Because yeah, it was an hour and a half. Never mind. First of all, OERs aren't a tool and they aren't a technology. They're an economic model. And so the sorts of questions we ask about tools and technologies are not appropriate to ask about OERs. Free always has an advantage, is always compatible, is always low complexity, is always reliable, is always familiar, and is very, very visible. So if you want to do that, fine. Second, I am personally, and Rory can speak for himself, I don't care about the students who are able to raise thousands and thousands of dollars to pay tuition. This is not the subject, the recipient, the consumer, if you will, of OER initiatives. I don't care about them. They're fine. They're raising all kinds of money. They can get into university. They can get very expensive professors to actually go to a room and explain things to them. They call it a class. Not a problem, right? So, and it doesn't matter to me then how students, quote unquote, respond to whether they are using them and what they want. Nor do the demographics of students seeking the quickest advantage, the fastest route to a degree, etc., function into the question of OERs. You asked without answering, what is the problem that OERs are intended to address? The problem is access. You know, the problem that OERs are intended to address is access. It's not the problem or the pseudo problem or the straw man of quality, imagination, regulation, comfort, variety, reliability. The problem is access. And given the tools, they can address the people who receive and use OERs, they can address these things for themselves, and for that matter, apply their own definitions of these things to that. It's when talking about OERs, and I know it's kind of hard for this crowd, you've got to get yourself out of the university student model where we are the professors and we know when we will deliver and you are the students and you will pay tuition and then maybe you'll get some free stuff. It's not that kind of issue. It's not a higher education issue. It's a basic equity, fairness, and justice issue. And it's not going to be subject to did it do well on the most recent empirical survey of students. Finally, as to cred, I looked up your page. I probably should have done it. This is to Liz. Should have done it beforehand. And published papers, there's a very impressive list of published papers with one functioning link. And I would recommend, because I'm sure you have copies of these papers, digitizing those copies and putting them on your website. And that would be, because you have an excellent history and a very credible record in academia in this country, and it's locked away from the people who would most benefit from it. Mm-hmm. So put them online, and if you don't have the web space, I'll provide it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm done.
Well, I'm going to take the panelist prerogative, but you can come after. I guess it's hard to argue with Stephen when he says that if you have to pay for it, it's not free. But if you open up and somebody charges for you, and it's also available for free, it's still free. Now, an example I could give is Amazon has put tens of thousands of public domain books on, and you can you have every right to copy them. They're public domain, but the point is that Amazon has put them on, and it costs you a couple of dollars to download them, and it'd surely cost you more than a couple of dollars to go to the nearest library and find the book yourself if it's available, and do it. So, to me, I see that as a service, and it's a service that's worth paying for. And they can do it with public domain materials. Now, if they were to do that with the orphan books of the 20th century that we can't get a hold of, which they are doing to a great extent, and they're charging a small price for that, once you download it yourself, the public domain books you can copy all you want, but the orphan books you can't because they're not free. They're not... they're not open education resources. So I do agree that they're trying to close it off, that once they can make money on it, they're trying to close it off as they are doing with orphan works. And people think the Mickey Mouse extension law was there to protect Mickey Mouse. In fact, it was more to prevent a huge body of material coming into the public domain. And that's the real reason behind the law. They didn't want millions and millions of books and movies and music coming on and competing with the stuff they're selling for. And that's what that's about. And to me, the issue isn't complex. To me, the issue is very simple. Why are we paying huge amounts for educational materials when we produce them? And, you know, why do we give them to others and let them sell them back to us? I mean, to me, this is pretty simple. It's, you just don't do that. Another issue I'd challenge Stephen on, and I think actually he'd agree with me on this, we're not talking about the producers here. We're talking about the publishers and the vendors.
Yeah.
It's not the producers. The producers aren't really getting the money. It's the vendors who are getting the money, the publishers who are getting the most of the money. And what we're doing is we're letting them do it. Now, at the same time now, and this is where, again, I disagree, that this is an issue about universities. I'm not to say it isn't also a freedom issue. I would agree with that. But it's a very clear issue for universities at this point because they're taking away our rights. When they lock it, when they lock your material, for you to break the lock, even if you have fair dealing rights, which you do for research, you're breaking the law. And I can give you an example of a problem we had. We had SPSS software on the disk. We put it on a computer, and we paid $800 for it, put it on a computer that it didn't work on. So we took it off that computer, put it on another computer, and we had it for a year, and it broke, and we went to put it on a third computer. And they told us our license was only for to put it on two computers, and this was a third computer. So they wanted us to pay another $800 for it. So these are the, and with digital rights management and with the strict laws, we will have no fair dealing rights. It's bad enough we don't have fair use rights for education like they do in the United States. We won't have any rights. And they're going to do that for everything. They're talking now, they have software now that will take your TV, your PVR, where you button which you can use to time shift your television programs, and they'll be able to disenable that. And then if you break that lock in order to use your PVR, which you have every legal right to do, you'll be breaking the lock, and that will be illegal. So that's why I feel going open education resources is better for us as in universities, in the formal system of universities, that especially... and for a university like ours, where the last bill said you must destroy your materials, your course materials, within 20 days of the final exam. But we have final exams every week of the year. I mean, it was just totally absurd for us. So there are real issues why we want to go OER, and I think they're pretty simple issues. It's a question of we don't want to pay $45 for student to access copyright to these other people. Go ahead.
I got so many things. I'll start with maybe the easiest for me anyway. The research materials. For me, this is a no-brainer. We sold it to the publishers and then we buy it back. It's a dumb economic model. We don't need to do that anymore. The technology is such that we can't simply self-publish. No brainer, and we're moving in that direction. I would put, though, in an entirely different category and treatment for digital course content. Because digital course content, unlike those research papers, is not, if it's done well, the work of a single individual. It is a team-based project. It's far more expensive to produce, and most of it out there, and this is to your point, Liz, is crap. That's the problem. We don't need more crap. We don't need more Merlot. We need high-end material, stuff that is field-tested, where there are teams of specialists building this material. We don't want self-publishing for course content. That is simply distributing garbage. Great, greater repository distribution of garbage. We don't need that. Well, that's the two categories constantly get mixed up. Research materials, individual builds it, self-published, not a problem, we're moving in that direction. Of course, content, if we treat it in that fashion, we will be stuck in the 1999 model forever. Thoughts? This, other than a nod?
No, I'm waiting.
Well, I would ask, what is your evidence that it's crap? And secondly, what is your evidence that crap won't be sufficient to provide learning?
Well, the lack of take-up that Rory pointed to would be one piece of evidence. It's not being picked up because it's hard to implement in your courses. When we're building a course, say I'm an individual instructor, and I am, as well as in the management side, I don't have time to go through all of this stuff, find something that actually fits in my course, is perfectly in line with the way that I want to teach it, and is high quality. Risk management. It's all about return on your time, return on your investment. You want to find the best stuff, the fastest. This is why the publishing industry exists in the first place. They are a shortcut to relatively high-end content at a lower price than if we were to produce the same content at the same level, doing it ourselves. Economies of scale. It's been around for decades. We use it in all industries. All of a sudden in education, we think we don't need that? I'm not so sure.
Well, you're seeing yourself as an instructor, as the consumer, which is probably the wrong model, but I'll shut up now.
Terry? I'd like to respond to that. That's the same argument that was made that people can't create an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
You know, just ordinary people. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And yet they have. And if you see the model of Wikiversity, of New Zealand these days, you see that they're getting a community to work, instructional designers, multiple institutions working on specific projects, and they're not building craft, and they're supporting each other, and they get the economy of scale, which is so critical.
So you're absolutely right. Let me clarify. What you're talking about is essentially an industrial model where you've got a group of institutions working together, large numbers of people, to produce content that is then shared. That is essentially the publisher model. What I'm arguing against is this. I'm an engineering prof. I think I can build some really cool stuff by myself. Frankly, I don't know anything about instructional design. I have laughable ability with graphics. And I'm going to produce it, and people should kiss my ass because I made it available and I'm part of the chosen group, which right now seems to be the whole OER community.
But
that's an entirely different model.
But your argument is an argument for OER, isn't it? That you're not capable of creating it yourself.
That's right.
So you can find it online. And I would challenge you to try creating something yourself or going online and finding it. There's all kinds of stuff out there. It is not that difficult to find.
Yeah.
This is a myth. People say, what, you can't Google? You can't put in the word into Google? You can find it. I'll give you an example. One of our profs, he started a course in green computing. And he went online and searched OERs, and within 20 minutes he found a full course in Moodle, which is the operating system that we use, on green computing from Australia. A full university course. He went through it, he liked all the material, and he's using the whole thing, but he's Canadianizing some of the points, and I told him, I bet our Canadian students would like the Australian examples more. He wants to have some Canadian examples in there. And instead of spending a year creating it, it took him about 20 minutes, and he spent about a week just putting this other stuff that really wasn't needed, and he knew it wasn't needed. He just wanted to do it for his own use, and it was all in Moodle. And there are lots of examples like that. And the idea that it's all crap is I keep hearing it from people who haven't been out and seeing it.
Right.
There's a lot of crap. But I'll tell you something. There's a lot more crap in university classrooms where they have no instructional design or teaching training. And the students are learning, as Stephen says, they're learning even with that, without the instructional design and that type of stuff. So, I mean, I just don't see it.
It's not OER itself, it's how it's produced. And what you're talking about is a model where it's produced essentially an industrial model.
Oh, no, it's not an industrial model, because an industrial model is a plant with a manager. This is community-produced community-produced material, not factory-produced material. It's a very big difference.
Yeah, the industrial model is proprietary.
Much more of a greater level of investment. Those are the characteristics of the industrial model. You may not want to call it that, but that's essentially what the industrial model is.
Sorry, I had an earlier point I wanted to get it out. It's just that Liz's example of the open university or open learning, a special issue on open education. How could somebody submit an article to a journal to somebody elsewhere that can't be read by most people in the world on open education research? This boggles me. But let me tell you how I switched to supporting the commercial or taking up the non-commercial on the journal I edited, the Rodel. We the European Spark Association of Librarians gave a gold seal, but only if you had a Creative Commons or equivalent license that that allowed for commercial use. Basically, you couldn't have the NC, the non-commercial, and we had attribution, no commercial, and no derivatives. And we thought, well, this is the open, and this is the purest form. Whatever, but we couldn't get the gold seal. And so then we started putting ourselves in the perspective of the authors of these journals. So try to think, well, they retain the copyright, and they license it, or we compel them to license it in a certain way. But from their perspective, if somebody in China takes some of these articles, binds them in paper, distributes them in a class, it really helps that author. It gets it out further. It doesn't harm anybody. And if the person's got a market that they can sell, then why not? The second reason we decided was we have been letting some of these indexers index the journal, and then they sell that index to the libraries. But when you go to a library database, you can punch it in, and some of our articles come up. But they're commercially done by a commercial person. So then we thought again, well, maybe by allowing that commercial use, we're exposing that paper to more wider audience. And so we've decided to drop the restriction against having commercial use. So small story. I guess I didn't go the way Stephen suggested, but as David Wiley, I guess I'll use it.
Ella?
First of all, I'm sorry I missed in your presentation, where I have blank technologies and watchdog. But just getting back to the point you made earlier about the question that came up about how do we distinguish what's good and what's not good. An example you gave, Rory, was of a professor going online, teachers going online and finding sources. And I think that I can certainly see the value there for this kind of exchange of resources. But my question comes up when students start accessing these resources. How can students go in and determine what is worth pursuing? And what does a learner who comes out, comes away from an education purely from these open access resources, what do they have in the end? How do we know that they've learned the right things or anything at all?
Well, I think Liz's answer to that was where you were saying that they used the MIT material and they wanted their money back because they were using these other. I think students are using these materials all the time.
Yeah.
I know my son uses them. If he can't get it from the text he has at his university, he goes online to get it. So informally, it is being used. And I think that student has a point. Mm. There is a point there.
Yeah,
I don't agree with it, but there's a point there.
Yeah, indeed. I'd just like to raise one issue and ask Terry a question. It comes from yours partly, Ellen. Our faculty members at UNB have to say every year how many articles have they had published in acknowledged referee journals. We're still in that model. I'm even in that model now because I know that on that CV and on the annual report every year, if I don't have refereed stuff in there, Hence, we submitted our book manuscript to a grueling refereeing process at your press. Now, we could have said, oh, let's just publish it ourselves, as a colleague of mine is doing in UNB, just go downstairs to the Imaging Services Department and publish it. But we're willing to go through the refereeing process. So how do you reconcile then putting authors, or how does the press reconcile that with openness and freely accessible information? Because, you know, we're going to go through probably a year now of tough stuff.
Well, to me, the going through a review process or a quality check or something, that doesn't lessen its freedom. I mean, I guess that author could still publish it in its first raw version. Mm-hmm. And but if they want to get it, sure, the press, that's a limitation on their freedom that they're willing to freely give.
Yeah, because they're not limited by their institution. The institution has placed certain criteria on how they're going to be judged.
Yeah.
And that's still an issue, right, Alan?
Most people realize the value of that peer review for the final product.
Mm-hmm.
Cindy?
Well, I might just make the same point about the Green Computing course. It's not like the professor has made it available through the Athabasca University system by himself. It's come into course design. There's a learning designer who has reviewed it. The editor's working on it now. Then it will be, or maybe it's already been through the process, and maybe it's already open. I'm not actually sure. I can say that it certainly went through that process more quickly than some of the others, but it still had all the same quality assurances and production value added that all other courses would have. So it's not like it's sort of an isolated incident to date, but it's not outside the quality assurance process or course design process.
But we're fortunate at Athabasca University to have that.
Given that everything is at a distance, then that industrial model in this particular case is what guarantees a certain amount of quality for all courses. At least there are some consistent and coherent standards there.
Gordon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. One of the things that I think is really exciting about the OER is comes from Liz was saying, and that is the impact that I think the potential has required during assessment and recognition and have a huge impact on what we as universities actually do. It's huge. If we think of that one individual student, I think more and more students are going to get their learning outside of the traditional institution.
Right.
And what is our role going to be? Our role is going to be moving further and further away from giving you information, but it's going to be that quality check. What did you learn? I don't know why we are incredibly obsessed with where the students actually learn the material.
Mm-hmm.
Is they learning in front of the teacher? Well, if there's all that, if there's good open educational resources, they go and find it. Who cares where they learn it? And then our job becomes assessing, did they actually learn it? And we give them a credential at the end that acknowledges that they learned it. So the more open educational resource there is, the better that it is. I think the larger the ramification it's going to have on what it is that institutions are actually doing.
Two things. One of them to expand upon what you're saying. It occurred to me that in your comments about how you needed to go through the route of having a peer review because the university demanded that you do that in order for you to be able to progress in your career, I'm wondering if you might all just comment on the role of the university, the traditional university, in maintaining and stifling this movement towards more open access to information. I know that you've touched on it in one way or another, but that really hit home. I said, well, there's a really good case in point. The tenure system and the system for promotion to universities is in and of itself seems a very direct cause of some of the problems that we're experiencing in the digital age.
Could I'll just make one comment. I sit on the review referee boards of a number of international journals. What's your name again?
Ron.
And Ron, most of the time I have to tick either reject or significantly modified because they're so poorly written. Now, it horrifies me to think that that person could then say, well, I'm going to put up my stuff, I think it's really brilliant. And I've just sent a two-pager back to the editor of the journal saying the research question was not well done, the blah, blah, blahs. And so then if it's reasonably good, we try and work with a person to bring it up to speed. And then they come back and say, well, thank you for the help. So that's my answer to your issue for now.
And I would support Liz in that, is that you're in a university system and they have rules for tenure, and one of the rules in most universities is that you do research and that you publish research. And if you don't, then you don't get the tenure, you don't get the promotion. I mean, that's a pretty simple rule. And for me, I'm the Associate VP Research, and I'm a bit like Pudd'nhead Wilson in Mark Twain's novel, the guy with the two heads, and one head drinks and the other head gets the hangover. And I'm in the situation where if faculty don't do the research, I'm going to lose my job. And so I believe in that system, and that we should have rules. And as Liz said, I like this. You know, you got to be tough on them, you know, to make sure it's good quality, and that's what we're there for. And I'm a reviewer, and I'm pretty tough like Liz, too, when I'm reviewing. It's got to be good stuff to get in, and I'm sure Terry would agree as the editor of Rodel, but, you know, it's got to be good. And what I find is that if it's no good, you say it's no good and tell them why, but sometimes it's very good, but it's really badly written, and then you help them, and you help them get through it. So there's different ways.
Well, does that apply to all of the OEM material, or just the journals that are submitted to?
No, actually, there is a distinction, and there's open access material, which would be the papers, university research papers. And OERs are for learning, they're classroom material. So we do make a distinction. This, today, we're talking about OERs, but because we've got all of these university research types in here, they keep trying to move it over to open access. And in fact, they are sort of, I mean, there is a relationship there.
Open access and teaching materials.
Yeah.
I review a lot of papers too. That may come as a surprise, but I do. And I'm equally tough on them, and I reject a far greater number than I pass. Some of the things that I do, though, I don't hide my comments from the author. I've never believed in secret panels. I don't believe that a review is necessary prior to publication. I don't think that review should be conducted only by a certain small select group of people. I agree with two things. I agree that there should be review of material to determine that it's of high quality, but I don't trust the university system to do that. And secondly, I agree that there should be credentialing to show that a person has produced something of high quality so that they can get their tenure or promotion, or that they can qualify for a job or a position. But it's not clear to me that universities ought to have a monopoly on that either. And I think universities have a case to make here, because I don't think that they've made it. You know, there is a great deal of very high quality content in the world, both commercial and non-commercial, that was not produced through the university research process. Therefore, to claim that only the university research process is qualified to monitor, evaluate, and credential, that argument cannot be sustained. And so I think one of the major consequences of OERs and open access in general is that the university system is going to have to learn to share. Not just its content, not just its teaching, but its power. And I think it'll find that very difficult, because a lot of its financial model is based on its power. And you know, I think that attitudes will begin to change a bit when the two parts of the university, which are really kind of in a conflict of interest, the teaching and the evaluating part, when these things separate, as they are slowly, slowly, ever so slowly doing, you know, when the teaching part has to focus on teaching to get results from an evaluation part that has to focus on evaluation, who cares where the teaching came from. So the danger, and this I think I might actually see some port in this room because I'm not really seeing much so far, the danger of this sort of model is that it descends or falls into a completely commercial model. And if you allow it, and I say you, allow it to fall into a completely commercial model, then those academic values, which actually are worth preserving, will be lost. So my fear is that by fighting so hard for tradition, the universities might actually be the cause of the loss of it.
I'd like to make just one comment on from a grassroots perspective in dealing with some of today's students, and I tend to deal with older adults, you know, 28 to 58, and they come from a bachelor's degree and they come to me in the master's degree, and I have a reputation for asking brain-burning questions, as Ellen knows. And what shocks me with every new batch of learners is that when I'm doing the equivalent of giving them various learning resources and not in the way that these two have been talking about today, I'm talking about another but related issue. I give them a whole pile of articles and say, look, read these for this week and those for that week. You could argue that each one is its own form of It's a discrete little resource they have to read.
Yeah.
They don't know how to think about these.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say, why did you have a problem with reading those articles? They said, we've always been lectured at. We don't know how to think. This is what I think, this is a really fundamental issue that universities and community colleges have to deal with. I mean, if I get them at the master's level, what the heck is happening at the bachelor's level or a diploma level? Scary. And then I get branded as the Wicked Witch from the West because I fry their brains.
East.
Well, yeah, but sometimes they want to kick me to the West.
Yeah, isn't the West the one that gets it, like, in the first few pages?
Yeah.
I have to strongly disagree with you on one point, is that older adults are not from 28 to 58. They start at 60.
Yes.
He's got a point there.
And what we learned from yesterday, Rory, you're not yet an older adult.
That's right.
I agree with that point, and I agree with it based on my experiences with people reading my own work and with my experiences, especially with first years coming out of like the high school system, and coming into my philosophy classes and like different material, and like, okay, is this going to be on the test? That sort of mentality,
yeah,
rather
yeah.
than here's something to work with,
mm-hmm.
which is why over the years I've become more and more inclined to want to foster, you know, the whole creation thing. Well, that's so badly expressed. But what I was talking about at the end of my talk, where I want them to create resources, to share resources, to have conversations
mm-hmm.
around them rather than just receive them as consumers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this, we have fostered in society and in education a consumer culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's part of this overall commercialism. And we have to get out of that, and we have to somehow, and we in this case, have to in some way, shape, or form foster the capacity in society to think, think critically, think literally, think. I'm trying to think
creatively.
Creatively, thank you.
Creatively.
Yeah. And this is going to involve much more than just giving them stuff. It's mm-hmm. it's going to involve working with them in an environment with this stuff.
Mm-hmm. If I could make a comment, that kind of complaint, which I've been teaching for 30 years, and I've heard the same complaint for 30 years, seems to run kind of like, they don't know what I think they should know already. Mm. What's wrong with the person who taught them before me? It must be their fault. And that, sometimes it's a valid complaint. Sometimes you have a legitimate reason to assume that they will know certain things when they come into your class or when they start your program. But I think a more useful approach is, oh, gee, they don't know what I expect them to learn. How can I help them learn it? And, I mean, I do agree with you. People don't, there's a lot of the students that I come across don't know how to look at and analyze a paper. So I should teach it. I should help them do it. And it's the same sort of thing in computer science, which I taught for many, many years. We throw them into groups and complain that they don't know how to work in groups. Yet we have never taught them how to do it. Mm-hmm. And so a part of this, I think, is looking at not only traditional approaches to doing things, and I will call it traditional, even though it's still viable and useful, but also new approaches to doing things. And look at, what do we need to help these people in order to give them the tools that they need to work with this and the skills that they need to approach it?
Takes time. In my experience, it takes about half a three-month course for them to move, to make that shift.
It does, and it takes, for a lot of these things, it takes them the whole 4 years.
Mm.
And you have to actually get at it every semester of the whole 4 years. Mm-hmm. And sadly, education is still not efficient.
But that's why openness is so important. If the education can be open, then that gives them the capacity to look and see ahead of actually getting into these courses how these things are done and to learn from people who are already doing it.
But the idea of it being so open that the student makes the decisions, I mean, I just don't see it happening. I think students like to have a path. It's like me, I'm an explorer, and I want to get through the Rocky Mountains. Am I going to go with an Indian guide who knows the way through, or am I going to figure it out on my own? And to me, I think you go with the people who know and the information that's there. So if you have a university course guide you from here to whatever the expectations are there. Now, if some students want to go exploring off the beaten path, I think that's great. Let them. But there should be a path for most students, who I believe the vast majority of students, and this may change in the future, that they'll just follow the path and get there and be happy when they get there. But some students will want to go all over the place. Or some of them, when they're not getting it on the path, they might diverge from the path to see if they get it and then come back and continue. And that's what I see. And for me, I don't think that precludes openness. I think that does allow for openness. But at the same time, you know, do it this way, you'll get through.
But that is choice, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a choice.
It's not choice when it's kidnapping.
Yeah.
And they drag you through the mountains.
Yeah.
It seems to me that's one of the really practical, useful uses for open education resources, is in answering students' multiple perspectives on their learning, different preferences and so on. So you create a course. However you design it, it's out of your own experience and your own understanding of the content and the context and what the student needs. And the students come in from multiple backgrounds and multiple different ways of learning and understanding, and your course somehow doesn't answer their needs. Statistics, as an example. I had trouble with multiple regression. I went to the web. I found all this cool stuff on multiple regression. I actually mastered multiple regression. But I didn't get it out of the course. I got it out of these open resources that are there. And students are doing this of their own accord. It would seem to me that better course design would include some components of these open resources for students who are having difficulty in areas which, as the professor or the course developer, you know where the problem areas are. So there's a certain amount of, you know, backstopping you can do, or some research you can do on the resources that are available out there. We hear from students in focus groups that the course didn't answer my needs. I could not understand this thing, so I went to the web and I found this thing and I passed the course because I used it, but not because I got it within the course. So knowing that, it would seem to me we should probably not be designing courses without a view to exploring what's out there and incorporating, at the very least, links to it for students with developmental visual needs or students with preferences for animations or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, the stuff is there, as you say, Rory, and it's there in all kinds of disciplines, and it's particularly there in difficult subjects like calculus and statistics and, you know, engineering and physics and so on. It's there. So maybe it's important then to get out of this, that if it's there, let's find ways to actually use it and incorporate it, even in ordinary courses, whether they're face-to-face or at a distance, online or not, whether they're synchronous or asynchronous, the resources are there, so incorporate them. Then we validate them a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, what you're putting forward is a strong argument that we have open education resources, because a lot of those resources are not open, and you can go to them and use them as a student, but if they're put into your course, then you can't. You have to get permission and go through the whole
thing. The best you can do is make a list of possible extra resources. If you're having trouble in this area, here's some possible. That's going a long way to meeting students' needs and expectations. And it's going a long way to doing that, whether you're face-to-face or whether you're in person. You know, and it's technology-based and it's appropriate.
But the big difference is that if it's an OER, you can actually put it on your server and be assured it'll be there for them. Whereas if it's proprietary, you have to link out to it, unless you ask permission. And usually they give you permission, actually, is what we found.
And the complaint that it might not be good enough, fix it. I mean, if you find something that is 50% of what you want, well, fill in the blanks. You know, improve it. Feedback.
Yeah. Well, if it's open education resource, you can do that. With proprietary, you can't.
So why don't people feedback? There did some data on the Open Learns repository at Open University. And they were finding, you know, all of these downloads, testimonials of people who had customized it for local examples and all that, they never put it back up. It wasn't good enough, they felt insecure, they didn't feel motivated. I don't know why, but strange.
Even if it's only a small measure that you've improved it, somebody else is going to pick it up.
Which is why a Wikiversity model is just have the one copy kind of thing, or you make multiple copies, but they keep it.
Multiple iterations.
Yes, sir.
Multiple iterations.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, what was just described there was basically the connectivist model that George Siemens and I have used, where, you know, we have kind of a course structure. So there is that guided path. But we don't require anybody to follow that course structure. So there is that freedom. And then we linked to a wide variety of resources, but we also linked to a wide variety of online services. We link to stuff wherever it is. We link to people wherever they are. And it's interesting because in the Connectivist course, we have exactly the opposite of the problem of not enough content being produced. We have the problem of too much content being produced. We got huge piles of content being produced by the people who are in the course all over the place. And, you know, if you went out onto the internet now and looked for material related to the Connectivist course, you'd find a wealth of material that was produced by the students in the course. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good. But the idea here is that under the right circumstances, the content can be made available and that content will multiply, and they might not send it back to them, but there's no place to send it back to, you see. And I think that was the secret, right? You don't have to send it back. You just produce it, and it stays wherever you need it to be. And I never did worry and I don't think George did either, about whether a resource would be there or not. And sometimes resources did disappear. It's the web. It happens. Because there are always 40 more resources to take its place. You know, and there's this idea that the course material needs to be this static, defined content that people will master. And I simply don't agree with that. The content doesn't stay the same anyways. And there doesn't seem to be any need to have that particular content or minimally that particular source of content.
Liz, would you like the last word?
No.
Well, it's time for us to go. Thank you very much for your
participation.
Thank you, Liz.